That was Jeanette Hill singing, Carol Jamajai playing the drums, and an arrangement by Hugh Stewart playing Robert Burns' Slave Lament. Together they are known as the Gady Lilies. Thank you very much for that.
Today I'm talking to Michael Donnelly, a former curator of the People's Palace, on the taboo area of Scotland's involvement in the trade industry, slave trade. Hello, Michael.
Hi, Paul. It's strange, although I worked many years at the People's Palace, it was only after I left the museum that I had the time to actually do specific research into the slave trade and the connection. And it was because I realised after I had left the museum and had time to look critically at what we'd done that we really hadn't scratched the surface on it at all. And so I turned to the book that we'd always used within the museum as our main source, which was Tom Devine's the Tobacco Lords, which is the standard work. And realised there was virtually nothing mentioned in it. I thought, well, like, couldn't you possibly have researched the slave trade, or rather the tobacco trade with America, and not dealt with the slave trade? Maybe it was just the parameters of his publishers had they decided to stick to the tobacco laws. So I went and had a look at his two-volume thesis in Strathclyde University, and it was the same. The slave word and all its connotations were conspicuous by their absence. So I realised that what I was looking at was a classic taboo area. Nobody discusses it, just like nobody at that time discussed the 1820 Radical Rising or the Friends of the People in the United Scots. And these were taboo areas that get skated over by establishment historians. So I decided that I would do some reading. So really from about most of 1991, I just went around archives and libraries looking at what they had on anybody who I thought might have been involved in the slave trade. And the main source for Glasgow was the slaveholders, tobacco lords, had got in first for their version of events, which is a very sanitised history of the houses, the country houses of the Glasgow gentry. You should paraphrase that, the country houses of the Glasgow slave owners, which was copiously illustrated by Thomas Annan, the photographer, showing photographs of the houses, telling the family trees everything except, you know, how they made the money, where the money came from. So on the basis of that, we had some displays within the museum. John Glassford's family portrait, which was a big collective portrait, set inside the luxurious premises of the Shawfield Mansion, had a black turban slave in it. And I remember to supplement that, we had gone out and looked in this was in the late 80s for adverts in the contemporary press of runaway slaves. So we knew that slaves had been in Glasgow. What we didn't know was the volume of the trade itself. And obviously, a tiny minority of slaves were actually ever brought into Scotland itself. Only the wealthiest of people like Glassford would bother to flaunt the Church of Scotland's disapproval of it. You can go into the trades house and you'll find rules and regulations where they say, do not traffic, brother man. Well, if ever there was an edict that was broken, that was the one. What I started with was looking at the parliamentary reports. I remember coming across one. In fact, I've got it here. I'll just check another day there. And this was a report the report on the slave trade, 1832, parliamentary report, so quite a copious thing. And they're asking the man, who is William Shand, one of the major Scottish-based slave holders, who went out with his brother William quite early in the 1790s, and probably went out as a slave driver. That's how they usually started. What we call them is an overseer, but actually they were driving the slaves. They were the ones who went out in the fields with the slaves and kept their noses to the grindstone. And he hadn't had his returns from his estates that year. And the thing that stopped me in my tracks was he says, I had a charge of a number of estates with whom, with 18,000 to 20,000 slaves. He wasn't quite sure what the total number was because he hadn't received his returns for that year. And that stopped me. I thought, my God, Roman emperors didn't have that many slaves under their control, maybe in the empire, but not personally under their control. So I did a little bit more delving into the Shan brothers and realised that they had started in a small way as overseers and slave drivers, but because this was in Jamaica and because of the climate, many slave owners never went to Jamaica. They sent somebody from, you know, if it was a clan chief like the Campbells or that, they would send a member of the clan, usually a young, physically healthy one, because they didn't last long in the change of temperatures and climate, tropical diseases. And so I realised that if you were exceptionally hardy, you survived the first couple of years of what they call weathering, you know, getting accustomed to the climate, you could then end up being the overseer for a number of plantations. And through that, you had surplus of slaves and you could set up a gang and you could rent out those gangs of slaves to other plantations. And gradually, by an accumulation, you might marry a widow of an original planter who'd gone out there and died because he couldn't stand the climate. And inherit her plantations, and gradually you could have this accumulation of wealth. These guys were actually hardy enough to come back to Scotland with their money and live in the proceeds. And they were welcomed by the universities. Glasgow University gave them an honorary degree. And they sort of did this grand process around Scotland and then end. They weren't the exception. I thought they were in terms of numbers, but actually it's easier to stick a pin in the map of Scotland, and find a place that wasn't involved in the slave trade than it is to find one that's free of it. For instance, Burns' song that he started the programme with, The Slave's Lament, Burns would be fairly typical of this involvement in the slave trade, where his father's buried at Alloway Kirk, and it's the scene of Tam O'Shanter and all the rest of it. If you look around that little ruined church, you'll find that there's plantation owners all buried there. The local landlords had made their money out of the slave trade, so it was quite a thing for them. They were always looking for people to keep their records. People who had a good copper plate handwriting, which of course Burns had superb handwriting, that would make him very attractive to a slave owner. And they would look at their physical condition, say, oh, well, he's a farmer, he's used to hard work, and that would be the ideal candidate. And they would go out there as an overseer, but the overseer would be oblique slave driver. And most of them died very quickly. Only the hardest, like the Shans, actually survived to come home and reap the benefits. And so this whole thing about Burns, a couple of years ago, they were trying to make Burns a poster boy for the slave trade. But the fact is, he's, thank heavens, he's Edinburgh edition of poems were a hit, he made money out of it, and he changed his mind, and he didn't get sucked into that. But thousands of other people who probably knew nothing about it before they got there did get sucked in. And that's where Glasgow's wealth came from, which was then reinvested into the textile industry, and then slightly later on into the development of iron and coal, and provided this basis for financial and industrial basis for the whole industrial revolution. So Glasgow's money essentially comes in via that. It was also very important to the fishing industry. West Indian slaves were fed on herring. They transferred the herring harvest at the mouth of the Clyde and at the mouth of the Forth into herring, from the herring buses into ships that were taking it to the West Indies. And they even had a ration for the slaves, how many slaves could be fed on the herring. So if the herring harvest failed, the slaves in Jamaica starved. That was how the thing worked. 100 barrels of herring for 250 Negroes. I believe that is about the usual allowance. This is again from this 1832 account from the Shans. At harvest and at Christmas, extra fish cod allowance. This is where the whole thing about saltfish and soul food still persists. It's a continuation of that habit into the present day. It was such a tie-in to the economy that, as I say, if Scotland had a bad year for fish, there was a poor harvest, then the slaves starved at the other end because they were kept working on the plantation, and quite often those who were just put the grad grinds of the slave trade wouldn't allow them to have their separate grounds. And it meant that if there was a failure of the harvest, they didn't have enough food to feed them. So a lot of slaves starved to death on the plantations.
Okay.
Southern trees bear strange fruit. Blood on the leaves and blood at the root. Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees. Pastoral scene of the gallant South. The bulging eyes and the twisted mouths. Scent of magnolias, sweet and fresh. Then the sudden smell of burning flesh. Here is a fruit for the crows to pluck, for the rain to gather, for the wind to suck, for the sun to ripen, for the tree to drop. Here is a strange and bitter crop.
So, Michael, what can you tell me about runaway slaves?
There weren't a lot brought into Scotland, but there were occasionally, and that was one of the ways that you could escape, you know, if you could stow away in a ship, or you a lot of slaves and actually were trained as fishermen in Jamaica too, because there was sometimes the herring harvest didn't arrive and they had to supplement the basic food plants and so forth that they fed the Africans on. They had to supplement that, and quite often slaves who had acquired, trusted slaves who had acquired skills in it, would stow away and end, you know, or even be just press ganged by a captain because he thought that was right. And they would be kept on board because if they got off the ship, they could regain their liberty. And but we do know that slaves were brought into Glasgow because there were runaway slave notices in the papers, you know, offering rewards and sometimes with descriptions of the slaves themselves. I mean, try being invisible in the streets of Glasgow if you've got a red skin and you've got tribal markings.
You were telling me a bit about Frederick Douglass.
Well, all the Frederick Douglass lived in fear for a considerable part of his time. Remember, he was a runaway slave in America who got to the north and established himself as one of the pioneer leaders of the anti-slavery movement, and came over to England and Scotland and campaigned against the slave trade. But he was always in fear, as all the pioneers were, that they would be recaptured, put on a ship that was heading for the southern states where slavery still applied, and they'd be back into slavedom for the rest of their lives. And he was obviously a target, so he had to be worried about that all these days. But the other way was to get, if you had particular skills, wood carving, there were certainly slaves that were employed in Beath, one of the centres of cabinet making in Scotland, and learned the skills there. But the secret with their owners was to actually take them and put them back on board a ship. That made, you know, back to the plantation where they could exploit those skills there. I remember seeing in Rednock House in Stirlingshire a big sideboard. I'd asked the lawyer who was showing me around, had this house ever any, had the Grahams of Rednock ever had a connection with the slave trade? I said, oh no, nothing like that. But when I went into the dining room, here was this long sideboard with two life-size Negro heads carved on it. And it clearly was a Jamaican piece. It wasn't a local piece at all. And they all went off to the sale room in London, and heaven knows where they are. But actually, the wealth that poured in was then used to underpin the Industrial Revolution, you know, with the collapse of the tobacco trade, with the American Wars of Independence, and the transferring of funds into the textile industry and various other things. I often wonder, and it should be a subject on its own, how much of the cruelty of the slave trade in Jamaica, which was very, very cruel, even by American standards, it was cruel. They had a slave code, a code noir, which meant literally a slave owner could do anything with you that they wanted. They could beat you, they could burn you to death at the stake, they could whip you. The islands were kept under control, because you think, how could this small white population manage to keep this huge African population under control by sheer terror? And of course, what they used was the workhouse system. They had workhouses in every parish within Jamaica, where runaway slaves could be taken, and they were automatically whipped, and they were put on the treadmill, and they could literally be worked to death. But normally they were kept alive because they were somebody's property, and the slave owners would report them to the workhouse, and that one would be sent back. Once they had them back on the plantation, they'd do anything they wanted. They wanted to mutilate and cut off arms or any of that kind of thing. So all the brutalities, I wonder how much of that bred in was allowed to migrate back to the early industrial mills in Scotland, because some of these mill owners were employing people who had a West Indian background and who had been used to keeping slaves in line. So from that, the transfer from looking after black slaves to the new white slaves being brought into the towns by both clearances and by starvation in Ireland, you know, wouldn't it be a stretch? So that's a whole other area of the taboo thing about the slave trade that needs to be investigated. Certainly Glasgow became a powerhouse of the West India influence. They called them, the Glasgow West India Association resisted any kind of reforms right to the last minute, and they were the ones who were proposing things like the apprenticeship system, which took over after slavery was abolished. Oh, you'll be an apprentice, you get to work for us for another 5 years for whatever we decide to pay you, because we can set the pay as well as the length of the apprenticeship. So yeah, there's lots of tie-ins like that, and you just need to think of the names to the last slave revolt in Jamaica, Paul Bogle's in the 1860s, is led by an African slave with a ex-slave with a Scottish name, and lots of the Scottish tribal connections, like the Campbells, become one of the major early Scots contingents into Jamaica, and that increased greatly after the 45 and the expropriation of Jacobite estates. How did the Jacobite lords earn back their money? They sent the youngest sons off to Jamaica.
So as a final question, we've not got too much more time, but how do you see the present and the future of studies about the slave trade?
I think it's very important. I think psychologically, as much as for any other reason, that and I'm delighted to see that there are black historians working on the slave trade, because they're the ones who can, for their own sake, tell the truth, you know, hold up this mirror to everybody and say, this is what actually happened. Let's have none of the bullshit histories that have been done in the past that whitewash this. And that's a very pertinent term for it, whitewashing it. But all the universities who sucked up to the slave owners, and or who profited by them, by grants or bequests or gave out honorary degrees, it's their turn to recompense the Jamaicans, the West Indians generally, for the slave trade. And the way to do that is to sponsor archival research there, and also here that specifically unites the archives that have survived in Jamaica, the accounts of the plantations, with the Scottish records. Bring it all into the light, you know, the light of publicity. That's the way to do it, so that it can't be skated over by any future publications like the Tobacco Lords, which means that there were these guys prancing about in red capes and hats and showing off their power in Glasgow, but don't explain where the power came from. That's all got to be buried. And a new history can only be written by a full cooperation. And unless it's financed out of these institutions which profited by it, I think there's some moves in the right direction. I believe Glasgow University are going to call a building, they haven't already done it, after one of their first black graduates. But that's tokenism. It needs to be a full investment on exploring the history of the slave trade, so that it's no longer a taboo, marginalised thing that nutters like myself practice.
Oh, that's very good. Thanks very much for that. That's very interesting. Hopefully come back to Michael and other subjects is where we've been horizon down Glasgow history.
Thanks to Michael, and a special thanks to Jeanette Hill for singing Strange Fruit, which was a song inspired when the writer saw the lynching, a photograph of a lynching in the 1930s. Bye.